For the week of January 16th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 88, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Are you exhausted from the Golden Globes? Did you have to stay up until the wee hours of the morning for the Golden Globes?
Not at all. I didn't watch them. I only watched the big four, the Oscars, the Grammys, the Tonys, and the Emmys. There are 8 gazillion other award shows, and I don't watch any of them.
That is somewhat sacrilegious, given the job that you have. We're going to have to ask you to turn in your entertainment journalist badge on the way out.
It's true. I have friends who have to cover, you know, all of them for outlets that they write for. I'm freelance, so I only have to do stories I want to do or need to do. And covering the Globes is not one of them. And I have friends who were up last night having to write. They were like, what do I say? There's nothing new to say about The Social Network. It can be a real pain when you've got 18 gazillion award shows in a row to deal with and write about. Because it's hard to come up with new things to say. So, of course, everyone's focusing on Ricky Gervais.
That's probably a good thing, given the Golden Globes ceremony and the telecast. And, of course, Ricky Gervais hosted it, and he was kind of biting, to say the least. But on today's show, we're going to be switching things up a bit, and we will be talking about the Golden Globes. Nicole Sperling from the Los Angeles Times is going to join us, and she'll give us the lowdown on what happened last night at the Beverly Hilton Hotel there in Beverly Hills. But then rather than doing our inside baseball segment at the end of the show, as we usually do, we'll keep Nicole around and she's going to tell us how many producers it takes to produce a movie. Then we've got a real treat for you, because once we hear what the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which is the group that puts the Golden Globes on, once we find out what they had to say about the best movies and TV shows of 2010, we're going to be joined by a longtime listener and first-time guest, Aaron Rich. Both Aaron and Michael are going to tell us what they think the top 10 films of the year are. Then we've got some video game news. We've got some news about Apple behaving badly. We'll go over all of the big showbiz headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, as we always do. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office over the weekend was The Green Hornet, which grossed $34 million. I think it's a record for Seth Rogen. Is he a film star yet? I'm not sure. And that movie grossed, I think, about 67%, 69% in 3D. Again, it's a little bit lower than usual, but not bad, especially for January. And number two was another opener, The Dilemma, starring Vince Vaughn and Kevin James. That grossed $17.4 million, quite a bit down from Vince Vaughn's usual reign, and quite a bit down, actually, from Kevin James, who's had four movies in a row open at $30 million or more. At number three is True Grit, another great week for the Coen Brothers film. That grossed $11.2 million. It's at $126 million total. It's peaking at just the right time for the Oscars, just like a lot of other movies, like The King's Speech, which is at number four and grossed another $9 million. It expanded wider than ever. It's now on 1,500 screens, and it's at $44 million total. I wouldn't be surprised to see it hit $100 million when all is said and done. At number five is Black Swan, another very big success story for a small budgeted film that grossed $8.1 million, and it's at $72 million total. I guess people really do love lesbian sex scenes. At number six is Little Fockers, which grossed $7 million. That's at $134 million total. And Tron Legacy, which grossed $5.6 million and is at $156 million total. Little Fockers looks like the end of that franchise, and Tron Legacy looks like it won't be the beginning of a new franchise. Number eight is Yogi Bear, which is at $82 million total. And then The Fighter, another really big success story that's at $5 million total, $65 million overall. Christian Bale won the Best Supporting Actor Golden Globe. So that's good news for the movie. It should do the same at the Oscars. And number 10 is the Nicolas Cage film Season of the Witch, which fell hard. That fell almost 60%. It's at $17 million total and will be off screen in a week. And number 11 and 12 are Tangled, the Disney animated film, which is at $180 million total, and Gwyneth Paltrow's Country Strong, which fell pretty strongly from its opening weekend. It's at $13 million total, but that's not bad since it only cost $15 million to make. I didn't see any movies in the theater this weekend because I was too busy catching up on my best of the year list. What about you, Aaron? What about you? Did you see anything?
Did you just call me Aaron?
I did.
You're jumping the gun. Aaron is on, in a couple minutes we'll be bringing him on. But I saw The Town. I'm catching up on some of the movies from last year, and it was a really good movie. I would highly recommend it. I know you didn't like it, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I thought it was a step down from Ben Affleck's first directorial debut. I thought it took out all the originality of the book, and it just became a fairly rote, routine, crime-busting movie. I thought the actors were good, though.
Well, for those who didn't read the book, and I'm pointing at myself, I thought it was a kind of a suspenseful drama. It takes place in Boston, in Charlestown, Boston, a section of Boston that produces the most bank robbers out of any place in the world. And Ben Affleck is a part of a group of bank robbers and falls in love with the manager of one of the banks. And it's I thought it was really, really good. Is it a step down from Ben Affleck's directorial debut? Well, maybe just a little. It's not as serious. Gone Baby Gone was Ben Affleck's directorial debut, and that was a really decent film. And I think this film is it certainly shows that he's got some real talent.
So what did you think about The Green Hornet? 70% 3D business. Is that a good number or a bad number? We were seeing 90% when the year began.
70% is about average. I don't know which film was making 90% 3D gross, but
opening weekends,
no, it was like between 75 and 85 for Avatar, and then it kind of dropped a bit on other films, mainly because they didn't have the 3D screens. But I think 70% is right where it should be.
Do you take out the IMAX sites because they might have gone to IMAX even if it wasn't in 3D? In that case, it would be 62%, or am I being too clever?
You're being too clever, mainly because that would make me have to do math, which I'm not all that great at. So it played on 5,700 screens. And 2,704 screens were 3D.
Half the screens, and yet about half the screens, and yet it accounted for 70% of the business.
Yes, that should tell you what that little surcharge is doing for the grosses. It's actually pumping up the grosses. And actually, this weekend was not a very good weekend box office wise. It's shaping up to be the least attended Martin Luther King weekend since the mid 1990s, according to Box Office Mojo.
Well, I know Price Waterhouse had a paper they put out on 3D, which they said basically what I've been saying for quite a while. They say exhibitors are charging too much for 3D. People are getting upset about it, and that eventually they may have to drop a surcharge altogether because people are going to get tired of paying it. There are 40 movies coming out this year, I think, at least, that are in 3D. That's, you know, one a week. And audiences are not going to want to spend $4 to $5 extra for every ticket.
I think it's going to be quite hard for the exhibitors to let go of that surcharge. Instead, what they'll do is they'll probably raise the ticket prices up of 2D films.
But they don't charge a surcharge for sound or color or widescreen VistaVision, which is what they used to do. Every new innovation, at first they charge a premium, and then they drop it back down and say, all right, we can't do that anymore.
Yeah, so you're probably right. You're saying that rather than raise 2D prices to 3D price levels, that 3D prices will drop back down to the 2D price level.
Right. I mean, prices always go up, you know, so ultimately, obviously, the price of going to a movie will continue to rise. But, you know, it's a 30, 40% jump right now in a lot of parts of the country, and that's insane, and that's not going to last. But the Golden Globes last. It's the 68th year that we've had the Golden Globes. And we're going to bring someone in from the LA Times to talk about them.
Yes, we're bringing in Nicole Sperling, who is no relation to myself, although I have to say, Nicole, I get asked all the time whether I am related to either yourself or Andrea Sperling. Andrea Sperling is a producer in the film industry, and you are a longtime entertainment journalist. You were with Entertainment Weekly, you're with the LA Times now, and you had a somewhat busy weekend from what I understand.
Yes, it was quite busy with the Golden Globes last night, and then the Critics' Choice were on Friday. It's been a busy weekend in the awards world.
Are you just relieved that Ricky Gervais was a little prickly because it gave you something to write about, since so many of the awards seemed predictable last night?
Yes, definitely. I think he was the highlight to the show because otherwise everything went kind of according to plan.
Well, now let's talk about Ricky Gervais for a second, because he kind of got mixed reviews. Some people thought he was a little mean-spirited, especially towards Charlie Sheen in his opening monologue. And even The Tourist, I guess he stated there's been some controversy over why The Tourist was even nominated. In fact, here's the clip of Ricky Gervais talking about The Tourist.
It was a big year for 3D movies. Toy Story, Despicable Me, Tron. Seems like everything this year was three-dimensional. Except the characters in The Tourist. I feel bad about that joke. I'll tell you why. I'm jumping on the bandwagon, because I haven't even seen The Tourist. Who has? But no, it must be good, because it's nominated. So shut up, okay?
You know, I think most of the people in attendance who were not being poked fun at loved Ricky Gervais. And those that were the target of his barbs were not at nearly as receptive. But he went in there knowing that this was going to be his last time hosting the Golden Globes, and he went for it. No one was safe.
Well, why is it going to be his last time hosting the Golden Globes?
Well, I think after his comments, especially the ones directed to the HFPA president, Phil Burke, I don't think they're going to invite him back.
Yes, he actually, while introducing Eva Longoria, who was going to introduce the president of the HFPA, said, you know, hey, it's a tough job, but I had a tougher job. I had to help him up off the toilet and pop his teeth in.
Exactly. And Phil Burke even said to me later, I have no sense of humor, and I will admit that, and that was not funny.
And do you think that upset him more than the jab about corruption?
Probably, because I think the jabs about corruption have been going on for years.
Right. Well, I guess a lot of people have been taking aim at the HFPA, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which puts on the Golden Globes, and it's about 81 members that vote on these awards. And it started with Ricky Gervais. I mean, everybody seemed to be directing barbs at the HFPA.
Yeah, it's true. Even Robert De Niro in his monologue that seemed to have been written by some comedy writers was throwing out the attacks on the HFPA. I mean, they've long been ridiculed. They're 81 members. No one really knows who they exactly are. They're not really permitted to talk to the press individually, and their methods for how they choose different films has always been questioned. And then this year, with Johnny Depp getting 2 nominations in the comedy category for The Tourist, which no one really would have ever placed into the comedy category in the first place, and then for Alice, kind of even just made it more kind of apparent that they're not always choosing by maybe the best standards.
Well, one thing I did notice is that when they introduced Phil Burke, they introduced him as writing for Film Inc. Australia, and that is a magazine that I used to write for, and they publish whenever they can is their publishing editorial calendar. Is, you know,
that's awesome. I'd love that schedule.
Yeah, it's just like, well, we don't have enough money this week, and right. So it's kind of a throwaway rag, and I thought, wait, this guy who writes for Film Inc. Australia gets to vote in the Golden Globes?
It's amazing. They really wield such incredible influence over, and they're such a small group of people. I mean, it's fascinating, really.
I don't think at the Academy Awards you'd have the winners or the presenters kind of jibing the Academy. They feel free to do it with the HFPA more and more so. And we've already mentioned that Christian Bale won for Best Supporting Actor. And I guess it was a drama?
Yeah, no, just general.
Just general.
Yeah.
And Melissa Leo won for Best Supporting Actress. Also, both were in The Fighter. Colin Firth won Best Actor for The King's Speech. Paul Giamatti won for a comedy called Barney's Version, I believe.
Right.
Natalie Portman won Best Actress for a drama, and that was for Black Swan. Annette Bening won Best Actress for Musical or Comedy, and that was for The Kids Are All Right. And The Kids Are All Right also won Best Comedy. And for Best Picture, Best Drama, who do you think won? Could it be the same film that's won every other award this year, The Social Network? And it won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Score. Do we even have to go to the Academy Awards this year?
Yeah, I mean, they pretty much laid it all out there last night with the Golden Globes. I think the only race that really is in contention, which was also presented last night with the actress awards in both comedy and drama, is the race between Annette Bening and Natalie Portman. I think those two are the front runners for the big night, and whichever way the Academy goes will be interesting. But other than that, Colin Firth, I think, is a shoe-in. It would be really surprising if Social Network does not continue their momentum that they have maintained since back in September, really, when the movie first opened. It'll be surprising if there's any more surprises.
But Nicole, do you think the Golden Globes is influencing the Oscars, or is it just sort of reflecting the general consensus in the entertainment community?
I think it's more a reflection. I don't think it's necessarily influencing. They're not usually an accurate predictor, but I think in this case, this year, it seems to all just be rolling out as everyone's expecting it to.
Well, now, you were backstage for the awards, am I correct?
No, I was actually in the theater.
Oh, really? And the theater is actually a ballroom at the Beverly Hilton Hotel. It's relatively small. And I think that we all kind of noticed Katie Sagal when she won, I guess, for Best Supporting Actress in a television series, or Best Actress in a television
series.
That's
right, for Sons of Anarchy.
She had to walk, what was it, like a mile and a half through a maze, and then climb a wall, knock over one of her fellow actors, and then finally she reached the stage. I mean, the whole show could have been much smaller or much shorter if they placed the potential winners closer to the stage.
Right. Well, they pack them in super really tightly, and it's hard to navigate through those tables on a good day. And so I didn't envy her that she had such a long walk to the stage at all.
It did seem like there were also some awkward moments there, specifically with Robert De Niro trying to tell a few jokes.
Yeah, I just thought Robert De Niro, we kept joking that it was like Shecky De Niro. I mean, he was really pulling up a stand-up routine, and he seemed to be having trouble reading the teleprompter, too, because all of his lines weren't really delivered, I think, as he was hoping them.
Yeah, at one point he mentioned that he was going to be releasing a DVD box set and would be in the lobby selling them after the show, right after he finishes taking pictures with the rest of the HFPA.
He went after them, which, you know, I kind of appreciated.
Right, and I think most of the audience did, and of course he won a Lifetime Achievement Award last night.
Right.
But I have, as a final note, I would say that the show did go up 5% in the ratings. It reached 17 million people, which is a lot of people in this day and age. So I don't know if the final words were written on Ricky Gervais. If they think he brings headlines to the show, he might just come back next year.
Yeah, it might be worth the pain that they all suffered through. But my assumption is that he's not coming back. And I you know, had talked to some people that work with him, and I don't think that's his plan. I think he wanted to go out with a bang, and I think he certainly did.
Well, I mentioned previously that we were going to be moving Inside Baseball up a little bit because Nicole's story is the feature we're discussing during Inside Baseball, where we talk about the news stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. And during the Golden Globes, when Christian Bale received his award, he kind of made a little comment when mentioning one of the producers of The Fighter, and that was Ryan Kavanaugh, who helped find the money for The Fighter. And that's because Ryan Kavanaugh is not listed as a producer on for the Academy Awards. If the film is nominated, he will not be one of the three producers that gets nominated. And you had an article in this past, I guess it was Friday or Saturday's newspaper, mm-hmm. the Los Angeles Times, that talked about how many producers it takes to make a film. And at first I thought, oh, this is a nice new joke I can learn. But really, what was the impetus for writing that story?
Well, Ryan Kavanaugh was the impetus for writing the story. He had appealed very aggressively to both the Producers Guild and then the Academy after he was left off the initial list that the Producers Guild submits when they announce their nominees for Best Picture. And he was not happy with being left off. And what's interesting about the whole thing is every time a movie is up for awards consideration, the producers on said movie submit their kind of credentials to the Producers Guild. It includes what they did on the film, and specifically kind of annotates their different roles in the movie making process. And then the Producers Guild goes through an exhaustive process where they vet what those producers say, and they call up different department heads who worked on the film to verify that what they're saying is true. And then they have a panel of three veteran producers that come together with the two people that kind of did the investigating, and they make a determination as to who should get the credit for producing. And Ryan was left off the list. Three other producers were put on, including Mark Wahlberg, who's the star of the film. And Ryan was not happy with that decision, and he went back and appealed it and had a bunch of letters of support written on his behalf to the producers. And then he was denied again. And then he went and further appealed to the Academy on the assumption that his film was to be nominated, and they also turned him down.
Now, if he was going to be put on that list, that means Hoberman or Lieberman or Mark Wahlberg would have to be removed, right?
Well, not necessarily any longer. The Academy has softened their rules. After Shakespeare in Love won back in the late 90s,
1999,
and five producers got up, and everyone was kind of appalled with the number of people up on stage to accept the award. The Academy went really strict and put in this rule that only three producers would be chosen. But then it became a situation where there were certain cases where people were left off that actually did do the work, like Albert Berger and Ron Yerxa, who produced Little Miss Sunshine. So after Little Miss Sunshine incident, they softened the rules and said if there's an unusual or extraordinary circumstance, we would allow for four producers. And they have allowed for four. They're allowing for four right now on The Social Network. It seems that there won't be an appeal there. And they also allowed for four last year on The Hurt Locker.
Well, I guess, yeah, you're referring to Michael DeLuca, who worked on The Social Network. He was left off by the Producers Guild on the original list. And then on The Black Swan, Mike Medavoy, a longtime producer, was left off on Black Swan, and he bought the script 12 years ago, and Brian Oliver, the financier and producer who helped finance the film, both of whom are now put back onto the Black Swan.
Exactly. And so it's interesting because you're having a situation where, and the Producers Guild have said, you know, we want to be inclusive and we want to put people on who deserve to be, and they did reverse their decision on two cases. So it is rather interesting that they still managed to leave Ryan off this time, you know, after all the appeals.
Do you think a part of that might be because Ryan Kavanaugh, who is 36 years old, he began his career as a venture capitalist, wasn't very successful as a venture capitalist, but somehow managed to get all of these hedge funds together,
right,
and get all of this money, and now he's going in and really helping produce some of these mostly low-budget kind of schlocky movies like Skyline, that there's some kind of jealousy there that this guy's doing this at 36, that he's relatively young, that he's helping the studios hedge their own bets on the films they're making.
Right. I don't know if it's jealousy. I mean, I think his camp would probably argue in the same way that Bob Yari's camp argued during the year of Crash when he was the financier of that film and left off, even after aggressive appeals, that there is a bias against the people who finance films. They're not given the same respect or the same favorable ruling as a true producer is. So that's probably what they would argue. But I've also heard from people who are close to the movie that he actually didn't do much on the film besides finance it. And people are telling two very completely different stories here. So it's interesting in that case. And the Producers Guild and the Academy clearly disagree with Ryan's camp.
And to clarify, we should say that none of this affects how many producers can be listed in a film or be involved in making a film. You can have 100 producers if you want. You just don't all get to go up on stage at the Academy Awards and accept the Best Picture Oscar.
Right, exactly. They don't have, I think, the resources or the ability to kind of regulate every film that's out there. And I think it would just be too time-consuming. But they are trying, I think, as an organization, the Producers Guild, to limit the number of credits that are doled out for producers because it kind of just demeans the job and doesn't make it as important as it really is when it's done correctly.
Well, and that's part of the problem, is that a producer's job isn't really defined. And you point out that it's a time-consuming job, and it often serves as a starting point for a film, and a producer can acquire a script or have a script written. They hire the screenwriters, the actors, the directors, or at least are a part of hiring some of those folks. They really do a lot of work, and it can take years to get a film made. And yet there really is no rule for what makes a producer and what the job is.
Right, exactly. And it can often be incredibly frustrating because these guys can shepherd a project for years, and then they're kind of, if they're not a financier and can't make it on their own, they're at the mercy of the studios to get it made and to get it done. And there's so many moving parts that you could have a star in and you could have a script almost done and someone doesn't like this and someone doesn't like that and someone's schedule changed, and then this thing that you've worked on for years can completely fall apart.
Would you have added Ryan Kavanaugh to the list?
I don't know. I haven't seen all the evidence.
She has to be very careful because she might have to interview Ryan Kavanaugh again one day. And doesn't.
Sure, exactly.
Well, and you point out here that there was some producer, Danny Dimbort is his name?
Right.
What did he try and do?
Well, I think he worked with Avi Lerner on the film Solitary Man, and he tried to put his 17-year-old granddaughter, who was a student, on the give her credit as a producer, because I think they thought it would help her get into college, which if it's come to that, we're in big trouble.
If it takes getting on a film to get into college,
it does these days, trust me.
Yeah, my kids are in big trouble if that's the case. So that's what he did, and I think the real producers on the movie went and appealed that to the Producers Guild at the very beginning because they were appalled by it. And it's like what the executive director of the Producers Guild said to me. I mean, these are people's livelihood. And when you completely demean it by just handing these credits out like candy, or, you know, a lot of times the talent managers will get it, or talent agents will get it, because that's the only way they'll give access to their client. So it just becomes egregious.
Well, Nicole, thank you very much for taking the time to fill us in, not only on the Golden Globes, but also in answering the question, how many producers does a movie need? And the answer is, who knows? We don't really, it depends on the film, I suppose.
Exactly.
But
your
work can be found at the LA Times. And do you have a Twitter account we should mention here?
No, I don't. I should, but I don't.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, now, well, that was, you know, that was the Golden Globes were pretty boring. They just showed us what, you know, everybody expects to win the Oscar for Best Picture. But of course, the Oscars don't reflect what the actual best movies of the year are.
Well, right. And our second guest today is Aaron Rich of the blog. Well, I guess blogs, really. All the Movies I Watch. And he also is a blogger for They'll Love It in Pomona, which is actually out here in Los Angeles. But Aaron lives in Brooklyn. He's a gentleman blogger that is part of the wave of quote-unquote amateur critics, and I put amateur in quotes, FYI, who have day jobs but are making use of the internet to share their passion for cinema. And since many newspapers around the country have cut back on local critics or have gotten rid of them completely, not to mention even city weeklies like The Village Voice also eliminating many local voices in favor of syndicating one critic over all, the entire country, really, the number of paid film critics have dropped dramatically in the past 5 years. Ironically, online, you can probably read more off-the-cuff criticism than ever. Some of it is fanboy-based, of course, while others have a focus like chick flicks, or, in Aaron, your case, independent and international cinema. He sees more than 200 movies a year, more than a lot of film critics, and people like Aaron are keeping a focus on art houses and indie cinema that gets less and less attention from the few remaining outlets for serious film reviews. Aaron, thank you for joining us. You're a longtime listener, and you're going to give us your top 10 list. When did you start listening to Showbiz Sandbox?
I think I started listening probably the summer of 2009.
Okay. Now, what made you start your own blog?
As your lovely intro suggested, I mean, I watch a ton of movies a year. I watch a ton of movies. I really like it. I love movies. And I think at some point I sort of got a little bit tired of trying to remember all the movies, just plain and simply remember them. And I wanted to just write them down somewhere. And I thought, well, you know, if I'm doing this, I might as well put down some thoughts on paper or on the internet, as it were. I guess the one thing I like about the blog format is that I don't have an editor, which is good and bad. I mean, I make spelling mistakes and I probably, it's not the most polished writing in the world, but I like that I can sort of go with it wherever I want.
Now, have you been surprised by how many friends and coworkers and people out there have discovered the blogs?
Absolutely. I mean, that's sort of, for me, the real the joy of the whole thing. I mean, I do it honestly for myself. I like the process of going to a movie and then sitting down and thinking about it a few hours later or a few weeks later, depending on how my schedule allows. What's great is that, you know, friends at work will forward it to a friend that they're talking to, and that friend will start reading it. And I it's not the world's biggest blog, but I appreciate that, you know, I have people out there who I'm really not in touch with who read my stuff. And I think that's fun. It's kind of flattering, but it's really, I think, the real interesting power of the internet, that I'm a critic for people who don't know me, which is really interesting, being a person who's not really a journalist.
Now, do you feel like you're filling a gap in film coverage? Because obviously you focus a lot on indie cinema and art house movies that play at places like Film Forum, IFC, Sunshine, Angelica, and Anthology, which are all art house cinemas playing here in New York City. And a lot of film critics don't even see the movies that you cover. I mean,
I absolutely. I mean, I'm really not a movie snob. I love movies, but I'm not one who's going to say I will not see the new, you know, Emma Stone movie because Emma Stone hasn't been in an independent movie yet. But I do love art film. I love all movies, so that counts. Art film and foreign films and independent movies and all. But absolutely, I definitely like following the things that other people aren't necessarily following, because I think there is sort of a lack of discussion in the marketplace now. When a movie like Blue Valentine came out, which I think is a very good movie, I like it a lot. Nobody mentioned that it's very, very similar to another film that came out earlier in the year called Everyone Else, which is a German movie, which I think is actually better than Blue Valentine. But they're both very similar movies about kind of the end of a relationship, which is, you know, very sad, kind of somber movie, but done in very different ways. And I think it's an interesting thing that, you know, between column inches that reviewers are given in magazines and newspapers, and between just maybe the fact they don't see all the movies that I see, that no one really put these things together, which is a pretty obvious thing if you see both films.
Well, now, what is your day job?
I'm an expert in watches and wristwatches. I'm like the guy on Antiques Roadshow who appraises watches and then I put auctions together.
Would you like to be a film critic for a magazine or newspaper or website?
I mean, I would love that. It's never really come up. It was never really the career trajectory that I had. So I never went down that road. But I would love to be a critic. Who wouldn't want to be a critic? I mean, you get paid to watch movies and write about them. It's a dream job.
Have the blogs been more important than your day job as far as how you see yourself?
It's a good question. Don't tell my work the answer to this, I guess. I hope they're not listening. I think so. I mean, I think that this really is my passion, whereas the work really is sort of work. But, you know, I love my job. I think it's a great job. But this is really what I go home and think about at night. You know, I don't think about my work.
Well, now you see an awful lot of movies, and you saw an awful lot of movies in 2010. So what, in your opinion, and then Michael, I guess we'll go over to you and find out what you thought of movies in 2010. What were your top 10 movies of last year?
So number 10 was Winter's Bone, the independent, I think it was a Sundance hit, right?
Yes.
You guys talked a lot about it. I thought, Jennifer Lawrence? I thought she was fantastic. Number 9 was The Oath, which is a documentary. I think it was produced in conjunction with PBS. And it's a really wonderful, it's an American documentary about two Yemeni men who are basically Al-Qaeda supporters, one of whom was in jail in Gitmo and on trial, and the other one was at one point detained because he was thought to be connected to September 11th, but he wasn't, and he was ultimately released. So now the two men are kind of living these kind of parallel lives that are somewhat connected and somewhat disconnected. It's very interesting. It's called The Oath. Number 8, then, is a film called Alomar, a man and his son who live in the Caribbean, I believe, and this man sort of is showing his son how this sort of simple life is in the Caribbean. And it's really a beautiful movie. It's very kind of poetic and lyrical.
Now, number 7 is a movie that we've talked about a lot on Showbiz Sandbox, and that is Human Centipede.
Absolutely.
I love the Human Centipede.
I saw the Human Centipede, I think like many people did, because I was thinking, you know, this has got to be the craziest movie in the world. I heard about it and I thought this is going to be so horrible. I think I have to see it. I'm actually not one for horror movies. I really just don't like horror movies. But I thought The Human Centipede is really interesting. I thought it was, first of all, I thought it was done beautifully. I thought it's absolutely spectacular to watch. It's just a very, you know, the art direction and the cinematography are just fabulous. And then, I mean, I think it has this amazing kind of Samuel Beckett kind of Waiting for Godot element to it, where you kind of have this existential question of it, which is kind of, it sounds ridiculous to say, but it's kind of, that's what I keep on coming back to. I really think it's a very smart movie.
And your number 6 film?
Number 6 is Mademoiselle Chambon, which is a French movie, a lovely film about a man who falls in love with his child's elementary school teacher. They're in love, but they have these lives outside of their love affair, and they can't really get together.
Now, Eccentricities of a Blonde-Haired Girl is number 5, and Dogtooth is number 4. Michael, I know you saw that movie. Where is that film from? It's not a U.S. film.
It's Greek, I believe.
Ah, okay.
But Dogtooth is a postmodernist art piece. I mean, it's hard to watch it and kind of, you're watching it, it's going to be really confusing if you don't kind of just totally put everything aside and say, okay, I'm going to watch a postmodernist kind of art thing.
Number 3 is, of course, Everyone Else, which you compared to Blue Valentine. And number 2 is Bluebeard, which a lot of people probably haven't heard of either.
Bluebeard is a weird movie. Bluebeard is a film, it's a French movie where you see the Bluebeard fairy tale, kind of a classical French fairy tale, told in a very kind of interesting and updated way, where you see kind of the period part of it in the, I don't know what it is, the 16th century, and then you see kind of an updated part from maybe like the 1940s, and you have two sisters, one telling the other one the story, and it's very kind of very interesting. It's a very interesting feminist film, actually. I think it's one of the more interesting takes on feminism in recent years.
And your number 1 film of the year is?
Is A Prophet, the
French movie.
French movie, A Prophet. I believe it was at Cannes in 2009.
Yes.
And you guys might have seen it there. I loved it. I love it. I think it's a very interesting film. I think it's a really kind of, it's one of these movies like, you know, kind of a great bit of literature where you can come back to it and see it over and over again. it gets better every time. It's done by Jacques Audiard, the French director, and having seen other things that he's done, I really think this is sort of the highest point in his kind of in his career. He's kind of built to this. If you see earlier films, he plays with some of the same themes, and I really like that this is sort of putting those themes together, and it comes out as a beautiful work.
Now, Michael, you also have a top 10 list. I don't know where you want to start.
Well, I know you were wondering, why are we talking about it mid-January? Well, Aaron put out his list January 2nd, but I know he'll be revising it if he sees another movie or two. He'll change his order, which is the nice thing about blogs.
Right.
And like people who aren't paid to be film critics every week, like me, we have to see films when they come out in the theater or catch up with them. Sometimes I see them at film festivals, but I'm always playing catch up. And when I hear about other people talking about movies, I say, well, I have to see this on video on demand. I want to see that when it comes out on DVD. So it might be March or April before I finish my 2010 year list. You know, I've still got four or five movies I definitely want to see before I'm done. But I have a preliminary list right now. And at number 10 is Carlos, the 5-hour film about Carlos the Jackal. And number 9 is Exit Through the Gift Shop, a very funny documentary about the art world that I saw, in fact, with Aaron. And number 8 is I Killed My Mother, which I believe was commercially released this year. It's a Canadian film by a very talented young director named Xavier Dolan. And number 7 is my first and only big Hollywood movie, Toy Story 3. And number 6 is Winter's Bone, which Aaron also had on his list. And number 5 is Blue Valentine, which I loved. I had everyone else. It's on my honorable mention list, along with Alomar and some of his other movies. And number 4 is Inside Job, a great documentary about the financial world. And number 3 is an animated film called The Illusionist, which was just lovely. And number 2 was Another Year, the Mike Leigh film. And at number 1, my favorite film of the year, just like Aaron, was A Prophet. So there you go. We agree on that, and we have a lot of overlap, I think, when you look at it.
Yeah, there's a lot from your list. There's a lot in my honorable mentions as well. I think there's some really good movies that you mentioned that, you know, I mean – what I like about a top 10 list is it just is it's a doorway to a discussion, really. And you say, oh, I like that movie, I didn't like that movie. And, you know, a lot of the ones that are on your list or on my honorable mentions could be in the top 10, but it's sort of, you know, kind of what really rises to the top.
Well, I'm just surprised that neither of you selected The Social Network.
That's on my honorable mention list, though. I really want to see it again before I make a final decision. I liked it. I didn't love it. I think it's admirable and well-acted and interesting. It's a very difficult topic, but I didn't love it. But a second viewing will show me whether it deepens or whether it stays right where it's at.
I didn't love it the first time I saw it. I thought it was interesting, but I thought it was sort of, I don't know what to say, kind of fake interesting. It's sort of, it's interesting, but not that deep. A movie about a guy who can't make social interactions, who writes a computer program to make social interactions. That's sort of all it was to me that I've seen on a lot of top 10 lists that I'm sort of laughing about. I mean, I think, you know, the Black Swan is so high. I mean, I just thought the Black Swan was horrible. I mean, the Black Swan is very near my worst of the year list. And, you know, I understand that people like it, and they, you know, I certainly, but I just, it didn't work for me.
Well, Aaron, you've been listening to the podcast for a while. Do you feel like Mia Farrow in The Purple Rose of Cairo? You sort of stepped in from the audience onto the screen.
Absolutely. This is my as a showbiz sandbox. I think I played in the outer boxes, and now I'm in the main box, and it's very special.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us, and
Absolutely.
Keep blogging.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, do you have a Twitter account people should follow?
Oh, on my Twitter account is Aaron, AARON_Rich, RICH.
And we'll also link to your website.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was interesting. Obviously, a lot of small films that a lot of people wouldn't have heard about, but we'll have links to his blog and people can check out his review and catch the names again and maybe check out some movies they haven't seen yet.
Yes, and I forgot to ask him what made him choose the name Pomona in one of his blogs, but maybe we'll have him on again and I can ask. We should probably move on, though, to music news. And we just have a small little item here about the number one record this week, which, well, you should explain this, Michael.
Well, Taylor Swift has the number one album of the week. It's at number one. So, heck, that will stand forever. Taylor Swift's Speak Now is currently the number one album on the Billboard 200. However,
it will also stand forever that it's the least.
As having the lowest number of albums sold in history, and this includes digital, of course. It sold 52,000 copies last week, and yet it's still number one. It's the lowest sales amount to ever be a number one album since they started SoundScan back in 1991. So in the past 20 years, no album has ever sold so few copies and been number one on the charts. This isn't a reflection so much of Taylor Swift as albums in general and music in general, the real collapse of music sales that we've seen, and not just physical CDs into digital, but just collapse overall. So it's early January when very few new releases come out, but to sell 52,000 copies and be the number one album in the country is just mind-blowing. It would be like being the number one film of the week and grossing $3 million. You know, it just, you just wouldn't believe it would happen. It's so low that it's jaw-dropping. And when that's number one, you can imagine how low the album at number 10 or 15 or 20 is. I mean, that just pyramids down. It's just unbelievable.
Right.
It's just, music is just not selling right now.
Well, 52,000 album sales for Taylor Swift, and then you go to digital track sales over the past week, which totaled 29.8 million downloads, which is actually down 29% compared with last week and up 8% stacked against the same week from 2010. So it's, you know, 29.8 million downloads. That's a lot.
Right. It's not a lot. The overall music sales are way down, and you know, digital sales count towards album sales. But we're talking; those are singles that were being bought. But you know, you can buy an album digitally or CD. It all adds up together. No matter which way you purchased it, Taylor Swift's album only sold 52,000 copies.
Hey, you know what else is down?
What?
Video game revenue.
Ah, tell me.
So, video game revenue dropped 6% in 2010 to $18.6 billion. Now, let's review. The theatrical box office gross is somewhere around $10.5 billion.
In the U.S.
In the U.S. Sorry.
In North America.
In North America. So is this international $18.6 billion?
This looks like it's U.S. It is. Well, this is MPD sales. It looks like it's U.S.
Along with $18.6 billion, do you want to mention some of the other facts that we've learned from this new these new numbers being published?
It's a drop from 2008, which was the peak year of $21.4 billion. So you're looking at like a 10-15% drop in sales from 2008. And people say, oh my God, the video game industry is collapsing. It's terrible. It's horrible. But again, if you look at the bigger picture, like we always caution you to do or suggest you do, and look at, you know, year-to-year comparisons or decade-to-decade, video games have grown tremendously. In the mid-90s, it was about a $3 billion industry.
$3.2 billion to be exact.
Yeah, and then in the early 2000s, it plateaued, it jumped up. You had new game platforms, you had new systems, you had new things going on, and it seemed to plateau and level out at about $10 billion. You had 2002, 2003, 2004. It would go up and down a little bit, but the industry had tripled in size to about $10 billion. That was as recently as 2004. Then you had the launch of the Wii and Guitar Hero and some other huge products that grew the industry dramatically, brought in a bunch of new fans like women and girls and older people. And then the industry exploded from $10 billion to about $18 billion. Yes, there was that peak year of $21 billion. But if you look at the big picture, see, just from 6 years ago, sales have increased 80%. To $18 billion. That's a huge jump. And that looks where it's about plateaued out. And now it's going to take another game system or another innovation, maybe like Microsoft's Kinect, to grow the industry again. But again, over 15 years, the industry has grown from $3.2 billion to about $18 billion a year, with fluctuations up and down depending on particular game sales or whatever. So the panic over a year-to-year drop is just moronic.
Well, now the top five games of 2010 were Red Dead Redemption, that's in number five. Number four was New Super Mario Brothers for the Wii. Number three was an Xbox game, Halo Reach. Number two was Madden NFL. And as expected, number one, Call of Duty Black Ops.
Which has the voice of Ice Cube. And so you have all my nieces and nephews imitating the voice of Ice Cube. Enemy care package inbound. They're all doing Ice Cube imitations. They don't even realize it. Well, but no, yes, those are the big games of the year. And
how many have you played? How many have you played?
I have played Call of Duty Black Ops. I have played New Super Mario Brothers Wii, and that's it of those five.
Okay.
But the positive thing is that they each come from a different publisher. So you're seeing a lot of different companies have hits. So that's a healthy sign for the industry. It's not all from one company or one publisher. So that's a good sign.
Well, we promised you Apple News, and we will give you Apple News. So let's move on to our digital media news of the week. And Steve Jobs is taking another health-related break from his job over at Apple. And that job, of course, would be, you know, running the place. And this is during a year in which analysts estimate some 50 million tablets are going to be sold, including a lot of competitors for the iPad, which is an Apple product. And exactly how is the iPad working out for magazine and newspaper industry? Let's find out.
Yeah, well, iPad sales are exploding, but iPad subscriptions to newspapers and magazines are falling down. Apple sold around 13 million iPads in the first 9 months of the product, and many publishers have devoted a ton of time and money to developing apps, feature-rich digital versions of their magazines that you can get through the Apple Store and get their app. But while sales of iPads are soaring, sales of the digital magazines are plummeting. Wired magazine is one of the most dramatic. It got rave reviews for its digital version. It sold 100,000 copies in June of 2010, and that's fallen down to about 23,000 copies in, I think it was December, with no bottom in sight. So it looks like people are sampling these magazines, which they have to buy issue by issue, but then they're not going to pay $5 every month for a digital version of a magazine. And other magazines have sold fewer at first, and they've also declined. So people sample them, and they don't want to try them. And there's a lot of reasons. Apple makes it really hard for people to sell subscriptions. Basically, you have to buy every issue. When publishers do sell subscriptions or single issues, they have no idea who bought them because Apple holds on to all that information. They refuse to share customer info.
Apple refuses to share customer
That's
info.
That's right. Yeah. And digital versions are very expensive, of course. They cost basically the same as the print version, and people just feel cheated. They're like, well, if I pay $5 for a print version, why do I have to pay $5 for a digital version?
As and a subscriber to Wired Magazine, okay, yeah. I went to on the iPad to the iPad version and saw that it cost $4 and said, there's no way I'm buying the same magazine twice. I subscribe to the magazine. If they want to charge me, you know, a little extra to get the iPad version as well, fine. I wouldn't pay twice the amount, meaning I think I pay $12 for the subscription. I wouldn't pay $24 for a paper plus iPad version, but I would pay maybe 1.5 times the version, so I might pay $18 or $20 and get both.
Well, $12 is obviously heavily subsidized, too. That barely covers the shipping of the magazine to you.
Yes, but it's the fact that they are shipping it to me that allows them to go and get advertisers.
Exactly. And so magazines and newspapers basically hate Apple. They're thrilled that all these other tablets are coming out. They hope they'll get a do-over and that all these other companies will succeed and launch successful versions, and they'll be able to sell subscriptions and know who's actually buying them. So they're hoping for a lot more competition. Google, which launched Google Books, they're launching a magazine rack, which they'll let, you know, work on any platform that you want, whatever tablet you get. And so more competition hopefully will help them. But right now, it's a lose-lose. They got to spend a lot of money to launch a digital version, and they're getting very few sales to show for it.
Well, a couple points here. One, on January 19th, they were supposed to release The Daily, which is a Rupert Murdoch venture in conjunction with Apple. And this is going to be an iPad-only newspaper, and that's going to be subscription-based. They've pushed it back, I think, for a couple reasons. My initial thought was they pushed it back so that they could announce it along with the announcement for the new iPad. The other, which they've actually kind of alluded to, is that they are still working on the subscription service for the iPad and for the iTunes store, that they're still trying to make that work properly in iTunes. So they pushed that announcement back from January 19th. But I didn't realize until, of course, this morning that Steve Jobs was taking another health-related break. Certainly, I think I speak for many in saying we hope he recovers and comes back to his job at Apple. However, I would agree with you that magazines are really, they loathe Apple because of this whole thing where they can't get the info about their own subscribers. And Apple, according to a news report coming out of the Netherlands, I believe it was either the Netherlands or Denmark, they contacted a newspaper and magazine and said, you cannot sell subscriptions to your iPad version on your website. You have to do it through the iPad. And
right.
you can't offer subscribers of your paper version. So if somebody's getting the newspaper delivered to their home, you can't then give them access to your iPad version. I look at all of that and I kind of say, and this is my prediction, antitrust.
Well, eventually maybe, but they don't own a market. They're just saying what they want to do with their own product. It's very tricky. It's very hard to have the government step in and say Apple has to do this for their product. So it's not a slam dunk, that's for sure.
No, it's not a slam dunk, but I mean, I think Apple has to tread very carefully here about how they go about restricting subscriptions through the iPad.
I wish they would open up, but I don't think it's an obvious antitrust case. I don't think it's a big deal. I think it's a big deal for the business that they're doing. It's not smart. They should encourage these people to work with Apple in many different ways to make it as good as possible for everyone. But I think an antitrust lawsuit is a long shot.
Well, yes, I was going out on a limb there with an antitrust lawsuit, but it certainly is restrictive, that is for sure. Now, you mentioned it should be a big deal, which is kind of my little cue that maybe we should be talking about some of the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them in our weekly segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop. Our first story this week is about Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. I wish they'd just, you know, open already so I could stop doing that voice. But Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark is delayed again. The producers have moved the opening from February 8th to March 15th. And since the show began, previews November 28th, that would mean that previews will last for about 3.5 months, one of the longest in Broadway history. Michael, is yet another delay a big deal or a big whoop for Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark?
It's a big deal. It's not hurting it commercially. It's the number one theater show in the box office. It just knocked off Wicked. Glenn Beck is a big fan. He tweeted that it's better than Wicked. It made the New Yorker cover. The cover of the New Yorker last week had a bunch of ailing Spider-Men in a hospital. One of them's using a web to change the TV channel. I mean, this show has entered the popular consciousness unlike any show I've seen in many years on Broadway.
Do you think that it's not opening because of two reasons? Well, I've got two theories here. One is that they're trying to milk the previews before they bring in critics to trash it. You know, they're making all this money. Why bother bringing in critical reviews? The second is that Steve Lillywhite, U2's producer and music producer that's worked with huge names like Phil Collins and Genesis and others, they're bringing him in to work on the music. So do you think that there's any truth that they're just trying to delay the opening to avoid criticism?
Well, that's what usually happens in the past. They know they've got a dog, and so they just keep pushing back the opening because they've got people coming to the show, and they don't want to let critics crash it. In this case, I think it's just an incredibly complicated show. It is getting poor reviews from fans and poor buzz, but people are flocking to see it, and I think they genuinely are doing an incredibly complicated show and are basically doing out-of-town tryouts in New York, and they've got a lot to work on. You know, if it had been brilliant, of course they would have opened it, you know, but they're you know, people are getting injured, they're adding new stunts, it's incredibly complicated, and I think they genuinely are dramatically changing and working on the show to make it better, and that they're delaying, they just got to make sure in ads they say this show is in previews.
1 week after Christmas, when a lot of people unwrapped new Kindles, Nooks, iPads, tablets, you name it, ebook sales dominated the charts. According to USA Today, among the top 10 bestsellers, ebooks outsold the print edition. In the top 50 bestsellers, 19 titles sold more copies on ebook than in print. That will calm back down, of course, in the coming weeks. Obviously, a lot of new owners of e-readers were excited and wanted to go out and buy a book on their e-readers. But ebooks and e-readers are not only here to stay, they're here to dominate. The same way that iPods and other digital music devices have crushed the CD. Michael, is this week of ebooks outselling many print books a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a very big deal. It's a turning point. It's unbelievable. It's really a titanic shift. I mean, you think about books. Gutenberg, that's how long we've dealt with printed books. It's been hundreds and hundreds of years, and it's going to end on our watch.
Dunder Mifflin needs a new manager. Steve Carell announced that this would be his last season. Now the plans are clear. Carell will depart in April, and the final 4 weeks of the season will be chaos as everyone panics over what might happen or tries to get his job for themselves. People both inside the cast and celebrity guest stars will, quote-unquote, audition for the part, including writer-star Mindy Kaling, as well as a return by Kathy Bates, that should be good, who has her own legal drama on CBS debuting this spring, but may be covering her bets in case that doesn't fly. Michael, is Steve Carell's early departure from The Office, which is the show we're talking about here, a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal, and it's rather bizarre. I mean, I would have thought his goodbye would have been part of the May sweeps, a tearful finale, you know, build up to his leaving the show, and then you start the new season with the competition to see who takes his place. So why they're removing their star before the May sweeps, I just don't get it. It's really bizarre to me.
Well, I guess it also kind of tells you that, you know, those sweeps months aren't really all that anymore.
Well, that may be true. They still use them to set rates, though. But you're right. They should go to a calendar year and ignore the sweeps thing completely. I think that's always been a mistake. But that's a good point. Maybe that is part of the devaluing of that.
Here's one more sign that the CD is on the way out. Sony shut down another CD manufacturing plant. This one was in New Jersey and had been around for 50 years, producing vinyl, LPs, and, of course, then CDs. At its peak, the plant produced some 18 million CDs per month. Michael, is the shutting down of this CD plant a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a symbolic big deal. And 18 million CDs per month, we don't sell that many in a year anymore, it feels like. It's not true. But if you look at the top 10 albums, if the number one album sells 50,000 copies, I mean, that's, you know, that tells you how much the industry has fallen.
The remaining members of Queen announced on their website that Oscar and Tony-nominated screenwriter Peter Morgan has turned in a new draft of the Freddie Mercury biopic that everyone loves. Sacha Baron Cohen is chomping at the bit to play the part, and they expect filming to begin later this year. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I mean, we've known about the project for a while, so the fact that they're getting closer to filming is not really that important.
And Freddie Mercury, of course, is the lead singer, or was the lead singer, of Queen. Blu-ray sales grow by leaps and bounds. The Blu-ray Association says that Blu-ray players finally outnumber Blu-ray-compatible PS3 game machines. They also say that Blu-ray DVD sales are up 64% over 2009, and Blu-ray rentals are up 105%. The total market for sales and rentals of DVDs in the U.S. was $18.5 billion last year. Michael, is Blu-ray's success a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I'll say it's a big whoop. I didn't think Blu-rays would catch on, and clearly they are, but this press release was so vague and had nothing but percentage increases, so we don't really know what sales are at for Blu-ray as far as the overall pie. Because they're so vague, I'm going to say it's a big whoop. If it was better news, they should have told us what the info was.
You're absolutely right, and that's exactly what I was going to say, is that, you know, 64% of over what? You know,
exactly.
Over five that you sold last year. And everybody knows that in 2009, Blu-ray sales were less than stellar. A rise was kind of only inevitable. Get used to more ads on YouTube, no matter where you watch it. The company has rolled out more of those ads that run before you get to watch the video, you know, pre-roll when you've clicked on and they're popping up on, you know, everywhere. But now they're popping up on Android smartphones. YouTube says it's generating 200 million views a day of its videos on mobile devices, and naturally, it would like to turn all those eyeballs into dollars and cents. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big inevitable, but is it only on mobile devices? I thought it was 200 million views a day everywhere.
No, on mobile devices.
Mobile devices alone? So how many views are they getting a day everywhere?
Hold on, let me call them and I'll find... I don't know.
Wow. Billions. Wow. That 200 million just on mobile devices, wow. All right. That seems a lot.
So that's a big deal.
That's a big deal.
All right.
The ads are not a big deal.
But, you know.
The ads are inevitable.
Yeah. I mean, and streaming video is kind of the wave of the future. In fact, Redbox, the DVD rental vending machines, had a terrific year with revenue growing 38% over the previous year. But the company's deals with studios, which called for a 28-day delay before they get their hands on the top DVDs, that hurt the company more than they expected. Though revenue grew, it wasn't by as much as they expected in the fourth quarter, so the studio had to lower estimates, and their stock took a 20% dive. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal, how much that window affected them. It surprises me a little bit.
Well, do you think that, I mean, one analyst called on Disney and others to other studios to turn the delay into a 45 or 60 or even a 90-day delay and slit the throat of Redbox for good. Do you think that will ever happen?
I mean, that's kind of amazing. My first reaction was, oh, gee, they should get rid of that window delay. That's my reaction was probably the same reaction Redbox had. And to say they want to get rid of the company because they still hate the idea of people renting movies for a dollar a day, I think it's a perfectly good business. I guess it depends on whether they see that as valuable revenue or something that's hurting the integrity of DVDs, which I don't buy, but we'll see.
James Bond will return in Bond 23 to the surprise of absolutely no one. At least no one who listens to Showbiz Sandbox, there will be another James Bond film, and it will star Daniel Craig. The producers announced a release date of November 9th, 2012, and say filming will begin later this year with Sam Mendes directing and Craig reprising his role as the cold-hearted assassin James Bond. Numerous studios led by Paramount and Sony are vying for the right to distribute the MGM flick. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. You remember earlier last year, we had headlines saying, James Bond series is over. It's dead. They'll never make another one. Daniel Craig will never be Bond. And we told you at the time how stupid that was, that they'll be making him for the rest of our lives and into the next millennium. And that's exactly what's turned out to be the case.
Michael Jackson's unreleased music isn't proving such a thriller after all. The album Michael, which contains odds and ends, including songs recorded at the home of relatives that Michael did off the cuff, is already out of the top 20. Meanwhile, The first single, Hold My Hand, with Akon, peaked at number 39 and is dropping like a stone too. A great single can turn any album around, but the indifferent reviews make pretty clear this album doesn't have any great singles. Michael, Guilts I mean, is the reception for the first release in what his estate hoped would be many albums of music a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because it shows how much the record labels overpaid for the catalog of unreleased stuff. You know, they thought they were going to sell millions of copies of the first new album from Michael Jackson, and he hadn't sold that much in years. It was just when he died that he had an explosion in his valuable catalog. So they overpaid, and we said they overpaid at the time. And this, you know, if Taylor Swift is selling 50,000 copies and she's at number one, think how many copies he's selling at number 21. That is really a disastrous showing.
Well, yeah, I was going to bring up the whole Taylor Swift conversation that we had earlier in the show, but you did it for me. And speaking of the show, this is the end of the show. We did Inside Baseball earlier with Nicole Sperling, who I'd like to thank for joining us, as well as Aaron Rich. Links to their work can be found in our show notes, which can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is also where you will find ways to subscribe to the podcast, either on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or via RSS. You can also find links to our social networking accounts, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. It's michaelgiltz.com. He's on Twitter. The Twitter username to look up is Michael Giltz. I'm on Twitter. My Twitter username is Sperling, and some of my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.